I've definitely been somebody in the past that didn't used to prioritize it. You know, I'll sleep when I'm dead. I've got a business to get started. And sleep was the first thing to go. I sacrificed it a lot. And it cost me a lot in the process. What does the science tell us about why sleep is so important?
For decades now of doing good quality research into sleep, that you look at people who are getting less than 6 hours regularly and those that need more than 11 or so, that as adults, that's clearly associated with more health consequences, like more diseases and mortality. But the really good news, as I said up front, it's modifiable. And once you know what to do and once it's getting it right for you, your whole worldview is different. Your whole system is different. Your energy is different. Your sensitivities in the workplace of thinking people hate you or not, all sorts of things are very different once you're getting plenty of sleep.
What advice would you have for people that are struggling? We wake up in the middle of the night, their minds are going a million miles an hour, all the thoughts. How can they go back to sleep, and what are some of the worst things you can do in those situations? Dr. Moira, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast. It's an honour to have you on today. And I should just set the scene before we jump into this conversation today. I read your article in the AFR a number of weeks back now. And as I was reading it, I was relating to a lot of things that you were saying and a lot of things that I hear from people as well around this whole topic of sleep. So I'm really excited to have this conversation today, talk about the importance of sleep and really how we can go about having better sleep, but also not stressing about sleep as well. So can you give the audience a little bit of an introduction to yourself, your journey, and we'll go from there. Over to you.
Right. Well, thank you, Georgie. Thanks so much for the introduction, you know, the invitation to come on, and I'll give a little bit of an introduction now. So I've been around in the health field for 35 years. Some of that was as a nurse at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, Australia. And then I've actually transferred, I was studying for quite a while to become a psychologist. I've been a psychologist for more than 20 years as well. And in that time, I specialised in sleep disorders, mainly for adults. So things like insomnia, nightmares, a range of things you can imagine, parasomnias, adult bedwetting, adult thrashing around, so all sorts of aspects of sleep. Either things happening during sleep or not being able to get enough of sleep. And then I realized maybe about 10 years ago or more, gee, this actually needs a lot more sort of education and prevention and awareness, not just waiting for people to have such a bad sleep disorder that they find me at the Melbourne Sleep Disorder Centre where I was working for 10 years. So it's been a bit of a journey. So it's been a real journey. And I think I just know from my work in health, all aspects of health, that sleep is so precious, it's so important, and it's also really modifiable. Once you know what to do, once you get the right advice and you're not seeking and putting too much pressure on the process, it's one of those things that will just sort of fall into place once you have your sort of your expectations and all your cognitions and all your behaviours lined up. So I'm sure we've got time to unpack all of that, but that's really who I am and why I get up every day and work for the Sleep Health Foundation, because I want us to be what Beyond Blue is for mental health and what the Heart Foundation is for heart stuff, that I think sleep deserves it too. And in Australia here, we deserve a big, wonderful, evidence-based place that people can come and get really good quality information. And we're not necessarily selling them anything. We're just selling them that sleep's important. And these are the things we know that are based on research that could work for you.
Fantastic. I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into this topic, because I'll be honest and I'll set a bit of a scene here as well. I've definitely been somebody in the past, and I'm going back probably about 5 years ago now before I actually realized how important sleep was, that didn't used to prioritize it. I used to think that sleep was for people, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead. I've got a business to get started. And sleep was the first thing to go. I sacrificed it a lot and it cost me a lot in the process. And that's when I learned to prioritize it. In our society, we're catching up, and the research coming out and the science is coming up now to say how important sleep is. But let's just start with this whole, I guess, the research piece and what the science actually tells us, because people seem to just know, oh, sleep, 4 hours is enough for me. What does the science tell us about why sleep is so important?
Yeah, it's a really good point that for decades now, for probably more than 30 years, probably 50 plus in the United States, but in Australia, about 30 years plus of doing good quality research into sleep and looking at people, big cohorts of people over long periods of time, there's a very clear association or you know, a curve, sort of inverted U really, that you look at people who are getting less than 6 hours regularly. So not just the odd night or, you know, but just sort of for most nights of their life getting less than 6 hours of sleep, and those that need more than 11 or so all the time, that as adults, that's clearly associated with more morbidity, it's called, you know, which is more health consequences, like more diseases and mortality. So you're dying younger, having a shorter life. So that's very, very clear. It's been replicated time and time again over, you know, long, you know, epidemiological studies with, you know, thousands of people being looked at. So we know that within that, the comorbidities, so the mental health is affected. No surprises there. Some cancers, cardiovascular disease, obesity, some dementias, some the type 2 diabetes. Like, and you know, you don't want, that's the bad news, is that then, and people know intuitively when you haven't had a good sleep, just how you don't feel very great with your alertness, and but people don't really know, and your grumpiness. But a lot of people don't realize that, hey, well, I didn't know I was actually putting myself at risk of those things. And of course, it's just with one aspect. And we know that some people could sleep really well their whole life and still get dementia or still get heart disease. It's not that sort of black and white. But it's very, very clear. It's not just speculation. But it just means increased risk. It doesn't mean that, oh, my goodness, I didn't realize I'm going to get type 2 diabetes. It's people just need to understand, like, that's the thing about health literacy. Most of us, unless you have a health career, you're not really well versed in health literacy. In the same way that, like, I'm not really well versed in my car. Like, the mechanics could tell me anything really about the head gasket and the carburetor. I don't really know. And most of Australians or most of the world don't really know either about health. And there's a lot of hype, and there's a lot of people can, you know, sell you a lot of stuff or make you very anxious about sleep when you hear this stuff about the increased risk and the increased association. So we've got to always, you know, put it in that category that it's just an increased risk. But, I mean, I've dedicated my career to, you know, it's been, we're into, my first sleep job was 1994, you know, putting electrodes on people's heads. And while I was studying from nursing to be a psychologist, it was my part-time job. And I just fell in love with the field. So it's been 30 years of looking at people's sleep and looking into their brains. It's very, very clear. It's not like this sort of just speculation that sleep's important. It's unequivocal. But the really good news, as I said up front, it's modifiable. And once you know what to do and once it's getting it right for you, gee, you know, your whole worldview is different. Your whole system is different. Your energy is different. The way you know, your sensitivities in the workplace of thinking people hate you or not, all sorts of things are very different once you're getting plenty of sleep. And we see it in our children, don't you? Children really display it very, very overtly when they haven't had their sleep, and the tantrums and the crazy sort of ridiculous behavior. And we're just a little bit better at masking it, but it's there for us too. And we just plow on, ignore the signs, but it catches up with us as well.
It certainly does, and it definitely did with me, and we'll maybe sort of go into that. But I think what people really need to understand is what actually happens when we are asleep, like what happens to the brain and the body and all of the cells when we're asleep, what actually goes on inside of us?
It's a very active phase. Like we used to think, can we, you know, it was just once you people were asleep and the lights out, eyes closed, nothing much must happen. But the world of science of sleep has told us that so much happens. There's an amazing amount of hormones that are secreted. So growth hormone is a big one. That's why children sleep a lot more than adults, because they're growing, particularly at first 2 years of life. Even babies that don't sleep well, they sleep a lot more in those 2 years than they ever will the rest of their lives. So they need it. So there's restoration with our immune system, growth. Memories are laid down. So that's another reason why babies have much more REM sleep, because in our dreaming type sleep, what we've learned during the day, we consolidate it during dreaming. It converts into, you know, longer term memories, and it's just incredible in that sense as well. Clearly there's sort of restoration of energy. So it's different theories, actually. There's, even though we know a lot about sleep, some of it's still speculative about what actually happens and, you know, why, the big question of why do we sleep. But it's definitely around learning, restoration, rejuvenation, survival of the species, so we can, you know, have a rest, because otherwise we would just, break down. Our cells need to actually calm down and go into a quieter phase. And our brains, got all the parts of the brain that are so active, there's a cooling off period. So our prefrontal cortex, for instance, it does a lot of work during the day, a lot of thinking on a plant, gets a cooling off period. Our cortisol and our adrenaline should have a cooling off period as well. But we know with people with long-term insomnia, just when they're starting to get dark and it's about 9 o'clock, there's a spike in their cortisol, spike in adrenaline. Just the thought of going to bed, the thought of, oh gosh, what's going to happen? I'm a bit nervous about going to bed tonight. But that's corrected once their insomnia is treated. So most of us should have a decrease in all those other, those stress hormones and the sort of that activity. So, of course, melatonin is the hormone that actually initiates sleep for us and helps us maintain sleep. And that's only secreted in dark conditions, so dim light conditions. So that's why a lot of, not all of it, but a lot of problems can happen. Not so much only with the blue light from screens and stuff that we know the last 10 years or more. It's people haven't got the message about the overhead lights, or like saying, you know, just sort of, they've sort of said, oh, I'm on my screen, but I've got my night glow. Don't worry about, you know, but it's not so much only the light from screens. It's actually the stimulation from it and the level of engagement and how long we're doing that. We might forget our sleepiness signs, but it's the overhead lights. A lot of good data looking at people forgetting to turn that off. And so when you're in light, whether, you know, when you're in bright conditions, the melatonin isn't able to, the brain doesn't get the messages via the optic nerve in the eye, doesn't get the messages to go right back into the pineal gland and help deep in the hypothalamus. It's not going to trigger the sort of secretion and production of melatonin. So the melatonin helps us, you know, and as I love melatonin as a hormone, because it has a, when it's going well, it has an inverse reciprocal relationship with body temperature. So as our melatonin's going high, our core body temperature goes low. And so that's another reason why if people are too overstimulated and still moving around and still sort of their body isn't getting that temperature drop as well. So there's just all sorts of speculation. It's multi-layered, complex things that can be relating to either the circadian system, the light-dark system, our stress levels, how much we're thinking or not thinking, how much we're moving around. Food, you know, I haven't even mentioned, you know, alcohol, caffeine, junk food, things that can be really stimulating. So it's no wonder that about approximately half of Australians have problems sleeping on any given night, and that about 15% have full-blown chronic insomnia disorder that meets criteria and needs treatment. So 15% out of, you know, several million, it's a huge number. And we need urgent need for doing more about it. Like we're only scratching the surface with access to treatment, education of healthcare professionals, all sorts of things, which I'm sure we can unpack in our chat.
Absolutely. You know, that was actually when, as you were speaking then, I was sort of reflecting on sort of just things that I have done recently, not even recently, over the last sort of few years that have helped me sleep after dinner, I'll turn all the lights off. And gradually my living room will just slowly get darker. And I've got an open plan living room, so I might just have the hob light on. But just as the sun goes down, I don't then flick all the lights on. I'll just naturally allow the room to get darker if I'm watching something on TV. But that naturally will just make me sleepy. And as you were just speaking then about the melatonin being released, because my brain's not as exposed to much light. So it's going, oh, it's getting dark now. It must be time to get sleepy. And I feel myself naturally just get tired just by sitting in a dark room. So
great.
Yeah, that's what you just said then. I was like, oh, that's...
Music.
Yeah. Oh, I think now when I realized how important sleep is, I literally had a tick box and I was like, I've got to do this. No screens before bed. I'm quite strict now with my sleep routine because I know how important it is. But what I'd love to, but what I'm really fascinated in is, over the 30 years you've been looking into sleep and working in this area, have you seen an increase in people with sleep disorders with like all of the stimulation, our busy lives, phones? Have you seen an increase in people having sleep problems? Yeah,
there is an increase. And when we do like, you know, not every year, but, you know, every 5 or every few years doing population data, like asking people about their sleep, or getting a Deloitte Access Economics have done a few reports for us, big quality reports that we've sort of outsourced. And it's definitely the numbers are higher all the time in terms of sleep disorders and in terms of just people talking about whether it's sleep disorders per se or just generally inadequate sleep. And they're two very different things, of course, because that's what I said about, you know, half of Australians tonight will say, yeah, I didn't sleep well, but not all of them, probably, you know, 15% or less will have a sleep disorder of some sort. So it's quite a different group, but nonetheless, both groups are way too high. So there's definitely an increase, but I wonder, I don't know whether we're across this as a society yet, whether there's a true increase or whether it's actually more awareness, therefore people, you know, going to a sleep centre, whereas 30 years ago there was no sleep centre. It's a bit like, say, other statistics around, say, suicide that, you know, say 50 years ago compared to now, of course, is way more. But I do know for sure, I mean, this is just pure speculation, and I wonder in the sleep world whether it's similar, that, say, country, town suicides, the GP, because they knew the family and it was all very stigmatised, they just would put motor vehicle accident or something. It wasn't recorded as a suicide. And similarly, perhaps with sleep disorders, people had them but didn't know they had them. And so whether that was sleep apnea. So the two main sleep disorders are insomnia and sleep apnea, and there's lots of others. In fact, in the chapter for sleep disorders, there's 80 different types of sleep disorders. And if you count all the subcategories, and that's including shift work, it's including parasomnias, which is those, you know, nightmares and the like. And then there's insomnia, different types. There's all sorts of, and then sleep apnea is different types. Circadian, so many things and go into sleep. But there's no doubt, it's undeniable that we have an increase in our stimulation, and that globalization has done that, the explosion of technology, like since 2007 with, you know, the smartphones and iPads. And then I think, again, another spike in 2020 onwards with the COVID pandemic, that people who are forced to stay home and not have their typical life, were they working from home or living at work? You know, the demarcation lines were blurred. And I think a lot of people haven't recovered from that. Even me, who knows better, I have less boundaries around my work these days compared to years and years ago. I remember my dad, like 1970s, 80s, coming home from work with a briefcase with a couple of manila folders maybe. But there was he didn't have access to work. It was just once he was at home, he was at home. And so, yes, there's definitely increase in sort of not only the boundaries around work, but just that stimulation. I mean, it's no wonder kids are loving, or not just kids, let's face it, it's all people that are using technology into the night a lot more than they used to. Because it's endlessly fun and stimulating, and it's just you can go down so many different rabbit holes, and it's very hard for people to switch off or to even see the tired and sleepiness signs, because there's that ongoing stimulation, there's the ongoing access to light, and so sleep is just sort of relegated to just not be a priority. And some people cope very well, particularly if they've, I don't know, they might be short sleepers. They might be people who used to get 8 or 9, but they're okay on 6, and so they don't really notice. But someone like me, who needs kind of 8 or 9, and I went to my nurse, that's why one of the main reasons I'm not a nurse anymore is that I found it really tough. I love nursing, actually. It was probably my favourite job. I really, really loved it, but I couldn't keep doing those all-night shifts, 10 in a row. It was 9 p.m. till 7 in the morning, you know, and then you did 10 in a row without a day off. And I was okay because I was in my 20s, but I just knew, I sort of thought, I don't think I can do this when I'm 30s, 40s, 50s. I knew I wanted to have children. I thought, this is not going to work for me. But my friends who were still in that, they just navigated it better because they are probably just don't need as much sleep. Better at it, not morning types like me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know for me, I I need my 8 hours. I always have, even since I was a young girl. I've always needed sleep. So when I don't get it, it really does impact me. And the one-off night here and there, I'm fine. But then the next night, I will be like out like a light bulb because I'll just be exhausted. Yeah. So, but
yeah,
the thing that I noticed the most, it was interesting because actually I had my mum stay with me. She came out from the UK and she was living with me for a month. And she's somebody that actually does struggle with sleep. So she'll go off quick. And then she'll wake up in the night at like 2 a.m. in the morning and her mind is just racing. And I think actually when I speak to a lot of people, this is the key thing that they struggle with is that they might go off to sleep because they're tired because they haven't had a good night's sleep the night before, but then they're up and then they can't get back to sleep. And I sometimes think that's more frustrating than just not being able to fall asleep in the first place.
Yeah, so absolutely.
What advice would you have for people that are struggling? We wake up in the middle of the night, their mind's going a million miles an hour, all the thoughts. How can they go back to sleep? And what are some of the worst things you can do in those situations?
Yeah, such a good question. Because that's probably, I'm not sure the data on how many people have this sleep maintenance problem or this sleep initiation problem. Most people have a combination, unfortunately, of it all, that sleep's just terrible for them. But if, funnily enough, we're in the process, like the researchers will have more knowledge on this in the future of what we call phenotyping, like actually knowing that not all insomnia is the same for all people, that there's different sort of types. But at the moment, especially on my long career, going and working as a clinician and psychologist with people with sleep problems, like I saw the likes of your mum all the time. Like it was, a daily thing that I've dealt with. And we still had the same, people were surprised to know that whether it's sleep initiation or sleep maintenance, that they still needed to, they need to sit up a bit later in the night. Like even though they say, oh, but I have no problems going to bed, but I say, I know that, but look what's happening. You're crashing out because you're exhausted, but you haven't really unwound enough from your day. So I would get them to sit up as late as possible. Like if you say they crash out because they're tired and sleepy at 10, I would say, could you try a bit? Could you stay up as late as possible? Like, can we push it out a couple of hours when you just sit, watch a movie, go and do some knitting, do some reading? Wait until you're absolutely exhausted and not watching the clock. Because a lot of people, particularly when they're really conscientious, they go to bed at 10 because they know they want to maximize their opportunity for their 8 hours or at least six, or, it's just more than what they're getting. So it makes sense, especially really smart, conscientious, self-starting people that have always been independent, always been very capable. They try and manage it, but they're actually accidentally shooting themselves in the foot by going to bed too early. And then they have this sort of maybe 3 hours or 4 hours or something that's good quality. And then they wake up and they're really alert and then they realize their mind's racing. So there's a couple of things there. So sitting up a bit later as much as possible will actually help you stretch out that sleep to be a bit more appropriate. Like even if it's midnight through to 5, it's a bit better, because especially in summer you might just get up and then you build it from there. You think, I've got 4 or 5 hours, that was pretty good, not enough for me though, I'll see what happens, I'll build it over time. And not going, so it's really important not to watch the clock and not go to bed at a set time because some sleep hygiene list told you to do that, or even someone like me, because we talk about this is the irony, this is the tricky stuff with public messaging. One of the most important things is consistency. So I'm not contradicting myself, but I sort of am. But because what I say to people is, if you please don't go anywhere near your bed or under the covers at least and with lights out until you are, absolutely ready for sleep, no matter what time the clock says. So your internal clock, your body clock should be the one that's dictating that. The other thing is, talking of clocks, don't have a clock in your room. Don't have a visual access to some kind of device that shows you the time. Because in your mum's case, and all of us really, we wake up all the time, a minimum once or twice an hour, but we mostly don't know that. So what happens is, once you start looking and think, wow, you're cursing that it's 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. or 4:03 or something, it happens every time. So it's at least taking away the visual access to the clock or whatever it is, the device of some sort. Helps people to just think, I'm not going to fall into the trap of even knowing what time it is and calculating all the missed opportunities or how much I've got left, and because it wakes everything, all the lights go on then. So it's best to just be awake and think, oh, well, that's it's normal. I probably won't even open my eyes if I can help it, and just turn over, maybe have a drink of water, go to the toilet and, you know, in the dark, and then go back to sleep. Put on a little podcast in your ears. If it only goes for 15 minutes or something, don't turn lights on. But don't have it going all night. But if you've got some kind of device where it can switch off in 5, 10 minutes, 15, you'll probably resettle. And a lot of people, the success that I've had with so many people is this piece here of just like, wow, I didn't know to do that. I always told you, blah, 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 blah. I said, well, this is the science. These are the principles of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which we call CBTI. And there's a whole range of things within it. But one of the core things is what we're talking about now is don't lie in bed awake. Don't do too many other things in bed. Like, don't, if you are going to read or listen to a podcast or something, unless it's for a really short period, 15 minutes is fine. But if you're going to do a long, watching a movie or something, you've got to do that out in a lounge room. Just to go out and do something else. Don't fold washing and do chores and turn lights on. And a lot of women say, I didn't give them enough instructions in my early days. And they do all this housework with the lights on, too much stimulation, too much light. So no wonder you're never going to go back to sleep. So there's lots in there that's to unpack. The other thing is that our primitive ancestors, like pre-industrialization or even way before, we used to have biphasic sleep. Like it was, and people who were in sort of civilizations in parts of Africa or parts of South America where they're not in a modern society with technology and lighting, electricity, the research that's been done there in the last couple of decades, they don't sleep all night. You know, they actually will go to sleep perhaps when it's dark, but have maybe 4 hours, get up around midnight to potter around, do some jobs, tend to the animals if there's no fences, or have sex, do a few things. And then they think, oh, I'm tired. And they have another few hours before dawn, before the daybreak. So they still get about 7 hours, but it's not been one chunk necessarily. So this whole expecting one big chunk is a little bit of a modern thing the last couple of hundred years or so. Sometimes people are comforted by that. I don't want to wake up in the middle of the night for 2 hours. I want to sleep. And I do sleep really well. Like by and large, I'm a really good sleeper, but only because I've been really lucky that I've sort of fell into this field and I learned it as I went to not worry about not sleeping. Every time I've had shocking sleep, like in pregnancy or in illness or when my brother died, my dad died, like when in times of really of crisis, I don't sleep. My goodness, so it's 3 weeks, you know, I'm emailing my friends at 4 a.m. saying, does anyone know any good sleep therapists? You know, knowing that I can't cure myself, because there's sometimes you can't sleep well if you're in crisis and I learned not to worry about that, and just I knew it would come back, and it does. But what happens is, especially clinically, when I'd see women like your mum, they'd say, oh, it happened back with my first baby. And looking at this woman in front of me is like 63. I think, well, this baby's probably 40 something. It happens. So sometimes there's something that precipitates it. Sometimes you have a sleep problem for various reasons, divorce, new baby, health problem, something terrible happens. And then that would have otherwise settled, but the perpetuating factors that keep it going for decades is the worry about not sleeping and labeling yourself a really poor sleeper, getting really frustrated with it, putting all this sleep effort in. We call that sleep effort in inverted commas. You shouldn't have to put sleep effort in. The good sleepers in the world, when we're being researched, and they say, tell me everything you do, and they just look at you strangely and they say, I don't know. I don't even think about it. I've got nothing to tell you. I just go to sleep. But they are the people who they do value sleep. They make enough time for it. They trust in themselves. They don't sort of ever panic if they're not sleeping. They say, oh, I just turned on the light and did some reading for a bit and I went back to sleep. They haven't even conceptualized that it was a problem and it just settled anyway. They personalize it. So maybe they're lucky they don't sort of look up health, you know, blogs, and they know not to go with those things because they've got to personalize it to their own situation. Because you can't get this kind of five top tips for sleep. I mean, we'll talk about some tips, but it really will depend on your age, on your sex, whether you've got kids or not, whether you're a shift worker or not. So many other nuances around sleep. Like it's a multifactorial, complex thing that the biggest things that are going on really are the light and the dark and the melatonin or not. and those sorts of factors rather than necessarily even your stress. I mean, stress is a big thing for people, but it's not the be-all and end-all when it comes to sleep. It's actually more other, you know, consistency, exposure to light, even consistent meal times, like having a routine during the day for your meal times and for your activities. And really that real predictability that we see with babies that sleep well during the night have had a good routine during the day, and they've got a lot of, and there's not a lot of sort of chaotic stuff. So we've got to work really hard as adults to try and make sure that we get as much routine as possible.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. It's really, really interesting. And as you were speaking there, I was reflecting on, so I had anxiety, God, going back 5 years ago now. And in the end, I was anxious about being anxious. And that's what I hear, yeah, what you're saying about sleep is that that worry is actually stopping you from one falling to sleep, because then you're going, oh God, I've got to get to sleep tonight. I had a really bad night's sleep last night, and obsessing about it. And then that causes you not to sleep. Now, you're a psychologist. You'll know more about the mind than what I will, but I am fascinated by the mind. I read everything about the mind. It's the one thing I probably would have done had I not gotten to start my business. I love psychology. So understanding how our mind works, how we've got these thoughts and our brains just chat away to us all the time. Do you have any practices or advice for when people do start to find themselves in that spiral of worry about sleep and things? How can we try to not stop the thoughts? Because when you try and stop something, it makes it worse. Like when somebody say to me, oh, just, you know, calm down. Or I'm like, no, that's making it worse. You telling me that? Yeah, correct. So how can you, and what advice do you have for people that are worried about getting to sleep, and how can they sort of become more aware of those thoughts, but also not let those thoughts impact their sleep?
Yeah, such a good question. And I love that you have that analogy around being anxious about being anxious too, because it's probably the same with so many things I've seen in my career, not just, because I was a general psychologist as well, not just sleep stuff. So it's really around identifying people, kind of putting them reflection or in the mirror on themselves, and really asking, do you think that's happening with you? Like being aware of that is the first thing. And they said, sometimes people are reluctant to say, sometimes people don't like to hear that, because it's a little, depending on how you phrase it, you don't want to be victim blaming as though, oh, it's all you're bringing on yourself. Or it's a very sensitive topic sometimes of just saying, oh, because yeah, you don't want to say, just stop worrying about it. Just don't worry about it, George. That's not going to work for you. But we can just do a gentle kind of bit of what we call psychoeducation, like, you know, psychological education, talking through the factors that we know can perpetuate the problem. Sometimes I have slides I can just show, like, you know, sort of theoretical models of how things work and where you get in this vicious cycle of worry. So education and awareness is the first thing. And then getting people, in terms of sleep, it's really important that they kind of sign up to a bit of a pact, make a bit of a pact with themselves, not just with me, because it's about them not pleasing me, to not really go into the bedroom at all if they're anxious or they're not really sleepy and tired yet. So sitting up. So the big, one of the most important strategies is that the person who's jumping into bed at 9 or 10 because they love their sleep and they're so frustrated with how awful their sleep's been and they want to maximize their opportunity and they want to be healthier, and they've heard all about how bad sleep, how important it is for you, they have to sit up and maybe curtail their time in bed to be matching the amount of sleep that they're realistically getting. So they might not have got more than 4 or 5 hours for a couple of decades. So we immediately say, well, why? Please don't chase 8 or 9 or 7 or even 6 sometimes. Like, so we have this, well, you know, it's kind of, it's stimulus control and it's sleep restriction, or I call it sleep consolidation, because you don't want to use the word restriction, because people have been restricting themselves and losing parts of their life for so many years or decades. So it's really signing up to that and realizing that that actually there's a method of our madness, that if you do that sort of slightly, don't really try to sleep much. I sort of try to stay out of the bed as much as you can until you forcibly to, oh, kind of keep my eyes open and then go to sleep. It gives your sleepiness, the sort of sleepiness becomes high enough that it overtakes even the most significant anxiety. Sometimes people who are so anxious that they think they're having a heart attack, like really severe anxiety, if they can trust in the process and trust in the CBTI and trust in their psychologist or whoever's teaching them themselves, and sit up a bit later and not watch the clock and just wait till they're sleepy and tired and do a high five if they got, you know, if they woke up in the middle, they're not going to look at the clock much, but whether they might be monitoring their sleep in some other way, maybe, but I would always encourage them to take that stuff off, put it in the drawer, keep it for your steps or whatever you want. But while you're managing your sleep and you've got anxiety about sleep and not going so well, don't, you know, it's not helpful usually to keep monitoring it. And that person, yeah, we can really celebrate that they might have got 2 hours or 3 hours, and then the next night, let's build on that. Let's make it 10% more. So it's about chunking it down into realistic, bite-sized goals that people can start to build their confidence. Because a big part of sleep and anxiety is building your own self-confidence to manage it, and to know that you probably will be okay. You've managed. Say you had anxiety for 10 years, I can say, well, look at what you've achieved with quite significant anxiety. You had your child and you got that job and no one but you is telling yourself, you know, people around you think you're doing a pretty good job. So you're coping somehow, and I know we want to make it better, but can just be always like, think, look how good you are, look how amazing you are and what you're able to achieve on quite significant anxiety and quite small, poor sleep. And sort of get that confidence back up. We call self-efficacy. It's been called, you know, decades ago when I was a junior psychologist. Self-efficacy was a buzzword in the 90s. Don't hear much of it anymore, but it just means that ability, and I love it. I bring back the self-efficacy, I believe, especially for teenagers who just are building that sense of mastery that I think I've got the ability. It's not confidence necessarily. It's more, do you think that you are an effective person, that you could manage this? And you will, and you know, and you're going to commit to this kind of this work over many months. So, say with this CBTI, you know, managing sleep, I can't imagine it being less than say 4 sessions over about, you know, 3 months, and usually a bit more than that. That'd be the bare minimum that it's going to take, because it's built up over decades. Usually, problems have been there for ages, like since childhood, and the person might be their 20s, 30s, 40s first addressing it. So it's about managing expectations about this is not going to happen in 2 weeks. This is not going to happen with your 2-week mindfulness course. Like, I mean, it might, but you've got to just understand that it's a really slow process and it's going to take a big lot of time and maybe a couple of different people to, you know, to turn this Titanic around. And that, but the person, this self-efficacy, like you as a person need to believe that you can do it and recruit the right sort of people around you that can do it. Maybe not professionals, maybe some self-help stuff and really good quality, you know, online evidence-based stuff. Explanations like that, and knowing that if you're 30 kilograms overweight, you would have an expectation that that's not going to change in the next 30 days. Well, if it did, it'd be very hard to maintain it. So it's a similar thing that you are going to take a bit of time, like weeks and months, and it's going to be another several months, if not maybe a couple of years of maintaining it. So I guess giving people the support and a bit of framing it in that it is a complex chronic problem, but lots of hope. Like there's not, you know, I've never seen anyone who I couldn't help with their sleep, even just a little bit. And that's why, you know, do make it 10% better tonight. And let's build on that. So, and managing expectations, don't expect it to be perfect. Don't expect it. Waking up is a problem, because waking up in itself is normal, but what's not normal is being stressed by that and being awake for hours, and then you feel shocking during the day and you can't function. Once it's interfering with your quality of life, so your occupational and or your social functioning, and you're making decisions saying, "Oh, yeah, I don't want to go for that that job. I don't want to get in a relationship. I don't want to stay." When you know, people are making decisions sometimes about their sleep that are affecting their social, emotional, occupational functioning, then that's where it's become a problem that you need to get more than just self-help. that you need to say, yeah, this is going on too long, and what I've been throwing at it's not really working. Because, yeah, so sometimes it's you accidentally throwing all this other stuff at it that's too rigid and too rules orientated, and I must have my bath at this time and I must have my chamomile tea at this time. But sometimes there's just too many sort of listicles, I call them listicles, of, you know, lists of things you're meant to be doing, but they're the things sometimes that spectacularly kind of blow up, and then you lose your confidence again.
Mm.
Sorry, I'm talking to you. I could talk all night about that all day.
I absolutely love it, and I think these expectations and these quick fixes and things, like, you know, if you've had an anxiety disorder or a sleep problem for 10 years, don't expect in 10 days for it to just overcome it. You know, it's a process. It's an unwiring. It's a relearning and things. So that's really, really important for people to hear. So I'd love to talk now about the whole sort of sleep hygiene piece, and what are some tips that people can use in sort of integrate into their daily lives. And what I'd also love to know as well, because I also think sleep routine and nighttime routine are one thing, but also what you do in the day, I feel for me personally, has impacted my sleep a lot. So for example, the days when I wake up and I exercise, the day when I get enough sunlight, day, like these sorts of things, you know, my nutrition throughout the day, all of these things late have an impact on my sleep later on. So let's look at the whole sort of people's lifestyle in general and what impact that can have on sleep and what are some good practices.
Yeah, well, you've nailed it, because I was always start with my first sleep tip is the morning, the first time when you wake up in the morning, it starts then.
Right.
So it's what you do during the day, and what you do 24/7 is what's going to support your sleep or not. So, yeah, so exercise, if you're a morning type and if you're not a shift worker. So we're assuming now someone who wants to sleep at night and be awake during the day, or that person who's listening to this who's the opposite to that, to try and adapt that to your night shift life. So it's really important that you actually get access to light in when you're awake for the first time, and you want to be alert during that waking period. So a walk is good. Or maybe people think, oh, I hate morning walks, I'm too, but at least sitting outside, having a cup of tea and your breakfast or something outside. So getting light into your eyes, don't have sunglasses on or glasses like this. I'm not sure exactly with, you know, what's going through. I would sit out there with no glasses on, or my walk in the mornings. Depending if you need your glasses, how much you walk. So yeah, getting light straight into your eyes will suppress melatonin. And then you're not sleepy once you get you, and that inverse reciprocal relationship with body temperature. Once you warm up as well, you're not as sleepy, and trust your melatonin's gone away because the light suppresses it. So incredible that says getting that activity. So, and then eating well. So minimizing caffeine, minimizing alcohol. I mean, I'm not one to say absolutely no alcohol, absolutely no caffeine. I mean, clearly that's probably a healthier life, but some people really enjoy just a little bit. And I think in moderation, neither of those are harmful. In fact, caffeine's got some really great qualities for alertness, and, you know, if it's appropriately timed and in appropriate dose, it's totally fine, you know, for sleep, particularly if you stop having caffeine in the early afternoon, like maybe at least 6 hours before your bedtime, your desired sleep time. So alcohol, same. If you had a couple of drinks and it was 3 or 4 hours later you went to bed, usually they're our standard drinks, and they'd all be gone anyway, and it won't really affect your sleep negatively. So that's good. That's good to know. So I would definitely make sure you have not a big meal, like, you know, small meals at all times anyway, but making sure you don't have a big massive meal just before bed, that you have at least a couple of hours and the evening meal is a bit smaller. So the sleep, yeah, so it's really I mean, those sorts of things I've talked about, they're the big picture ones around sort of access to light and, but the five priority things are valuing sleep, prioritizing sleep, personalizing any sort of tips to you in your situation, just trusting in your systems and yourself that it will get better. Don't panic about even if it's 3 weeks of poor sleep, don't panic. Trust if you can. And protecting. So making sure that you do put yourself in an environment that's conducive to sleep. So with the darkness, with the quietness, with good routines, with not too much stimulating work at night, even if you're at a kinder committee meeting, doesn't have to be a full-on work thing, but or training for your footy team, when you come back from that, you do need a couple of hours to unwind. So don't worry that you might have a later night. You're better off sitting up and unwinding than falling into that crashing out, because then you will wake up because you're still stimulated. You've only crashed out into sleep because you're so tired and sleep deprived. But you haven't necessarily unwound and let go of the day yet. So they're the main tips that I think anyone watching this, listening to this, will be able to try straight away. And then maybe also ask themselves, do they think that they've got quite significant other stuff going on? Like it may be a mental health issue that's driving the sleep stuff. Maybe it's an autoimmune thing that's driving the tiredness or the alertness, or something's going on, you know, with their medications or, you know, substance misuse. Maybe they're in just a really bad job or a really poor relationship that they need to sort of address those things. So interestingly, often I'd get people's sleep fixed up but then they still weren't really that happy, or they said I'm really tired still. And there were these other things going on. You know, I've got to think about iron and thyroid and sleep disorders. We're talking about sort of insomnia here, or, you know, sleep disruption kind of stuff. But thinking about people who are snorers, need to really check out whether they've got maybe undiagnosed sleep apnea. There might be hypersomnia, there's, you know, idiopathic hypersomnia, narcolepsy, sleep apnea, things like that people can feel really excessively sleepy during the day. We call it EDS, excessive daytime sleepiness. So understanding whether you have that, like, or whether fatigue's very different because you're just tired but you're not really sleepy. But excessive daytime sleepiness is can't stay awake, like I'm really, really sleepy. And just getting a good old medical check, like blood pressure, blood tests, some basic things can be really helpful rather than just putting all your eggs into the sleep basket. Because particularly if you've tried all the stuff I've talked about and nothing works, then I would say, look, I'm very experienced. I reckon that you should have, you know. But then I was lucky always working alongside medical doctors. Like most of my career I've been in, you know, with these teams. I think multidisciplinary teams is so important that you can actually all, you know, it was really nice knowing that these people had a sleep study or that had their bloods done. And then, you know, it was just really great. Really great. Like long live. If I do go back into my clinical world one day, I would definitely work alongside an MDT, multidisciplinary team.
I think all of those tips and routines and things are just so powerful. And I think that for me, I love what you said about it starts in the morning, because this is what people don't realize. And a really big practice for me has been just the power of like just meditation and just learning to slow down my mind, slow down those thoughts and just become more present. Because what I found when I did have my anxiety disorder, for example, is that my thoughts would spiral, and if I had learned just to be aware of them and challenge them and go, oh, that's not true, that's just a thought, I wouldn't have got myself into these situations. So I love what you said there about it starts in the morning and starts with these morning practices. But yeah, definitely meditation has been a really powerful one for me. But, you know, we are going to go through trauma in life. Things are going to come up. And if someone's listening to this right now that's gone through a really tough time, maybe it's a breakup, maybe it's they've lost their job and they're under a lot of stress, like one piece of advice that you could give them that might just sort of help them today get a better night's sleep or just sort of release the burden of worry, like anything they could do that could just make that slight bit of difference.
I think that they should know that sleep will be disturbed in this really stressful acute time, but they've had a big loss, they've had some kind of trauma. So sleep will be disturbed, point blank. That's just a fact. For most people, for some people not. Some people sleep like they just go into this amazing oblivion, but a lot of people do have sleep disturbance. So to understand, let that be, let this roll with what you can get, celebrate the bits of sleep, even if it's broken. Definitely meditation, definitely trying to really calm your breathing. Trying to be as routine as possible, eating and exercising as well as you can, minimizing the booze. That's the other thing, that stressful times. A lot of people increase exercise, increase alcohol, decrease exercise.
Yeah.
And that's problematic. They will make sleep worse. So the one thing really is just to accept that it's going to be normal. Don't watch the clock. Don't monitor it too much. Just, you know, but again, once if it's been many, many weeks, and nothing's getting better and it's interfering or affecting your quality of life, then you need to address it then. But otherwise, it's kind of probably people would stop a lot of long-term problems if they could just roll with the acute stuff a bit more, because sleep will return if we don't focus too much on it.
And that's the key, to not focus too much on it, because as soon as you obsess about anything, it starts to take over your whole life, which is just, yeah, been there, done that. But
yes.
Look, it's, I think we can just all agree that sleep is so important, and it is something that probably hasn't been discussed enough, certainly not in sort of my past time and throughout my lifetime. And now understanding it more and understanding the research and the science and the health benefits from sleep, I now do make it a priority, and it's something that it impacts everything. If I don't get a good night's sleep for a long period of time, I just don't feel like myself. So, but then again, it's like not just like detaching from that as well, and then not obsessing about that as well, which is obviously what we've spoken about today. But look, it's so complex and it's such a fascinating subject, and I would love to have you back on to talk more about it, because there's so many other things that I could go on, but I am just so conscious of time. But just in terms of like the one final thing that I was thinking as you were speaking then, something that comes up a lot for me is parents, new parents that are, you know, not sleeping, not their kids aren't sleeping for the night. Like, what advice would you have for like new parents that are struggling to just get a full night's sleep at the minute?
Yeah, again, just to know that this will pass. Mm. It won't be forever. And it's quite normal for young children or even older children to not sleep all night. It's just unfortunately part of the territory. But to make sure that they get as much support as possible, ask for help. It takes a village to raise a child. It can never be one person doing everything. They will just burn out, particularly because you won't be able to get the sleep you need because you're working as well, et cetera. So being really have a lot of self-compassion, getting support wherever possible, and sleeping when you can, like become the world's best catnapper if you can, particularly while the baby's sleeping. And I know in my mother's group, I mean, my kids are older now, but 23 years ago in my first mother's group, you know, I was a great sleeper when the baby was asleep because I didn't really care how messy the house was and what we ate that night. I could just throw things together. But a lot of people are much more perfectionistic, worried about the house and worried about what people are going to think of them. So that's one thing I really important to just let that sort of go if you can temporarily, for the importance of just rebooting your brain, because at that restorative, the stuff we talked about at the top of this podcast, you know, the benefits of sleep and that restoration, the rejuvenation, supporting your mental health, decreasing stress hormones, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so wherever possible. But even if you can't sleep, at least go and lie down when the baby's lying down, or you know, older kids. So it's not just babies, we're talking about babies here, but we all know that people can have disrupted sleep for a long time with children. Yeah,
100%.
But I can just encourage them to also think there's good help available as well. We have very good, the waiting list might be long, but sometimes private health insurance or whether you're uninsured, there's help out there. There's wonderful resources at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, the MCRI, attached to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. So online, you can look that up. There's amazing strategies with how to get, because one of the best things you could do, and a big investment in your child's health and your well-being, is to get them sleeping well. Like, invest in good routines and invest in good quality information and make it a priority, because it's a really great life skill to teach them. If they can sleep well and they understand the importance of it, and then you're strict with them too when they're trying to, you know, come out and, you know, muck around all night, say, look, you know, mum and dad, we need to sleep too. Or mums and mums and whatever, it might be one parent, we need to sleep too, and we're, you know, sleep's super important. So it actually just helps shape the whole dialogue, you know, around, you know, kids and their health. It's just it's for all the, for them to know as soon as possible that sleep's important, and then it's a good skill to have. Like, it's, I would put it up there with reading and their walking and all the other milestones. If you know, just try and make them a good sleeper if you can. And it might not be the best sleeper in the world, but good enough. Be a good enough sleeper that they're not cranky all the time, that you're not cranky all the time. And reach out for help, you know, online or via maternal and child health nurse. There's, you know, there's help out there. There's, we've got a wonderful amount of resources here in Australia. Not enough, of course. We've got to do a lot more, but people need to know where to find it and start looking at, you know, places like your local children's hospital or maternal and child health nurses, and they should give you good pathways and, you know, to better help and better support.
Amazing. Solid advice. And I was just thinking, yeah, as you're speaking there, it's all very well sleep, but I think there are certain times in life where people can't prioritize it, and being obviously a new mum and a new parent is one of them. But Dr. Mora, I could speak to you all day, but for those that want to find out more about you and your work, where can I send people? Where do you hang out the most?
I would really love your listeners to come to the Sleep Health Foundation website.
Yeah.
So sleephealthfoundation.org.au. We've got an array of different fact sheets. Some of them are on different sleep topics, like sleep disorders. And some of them are just on things like jet lag and melatonin and kids, or just different, just information that's just there, like a range of, just have a little read. But sign up to our newsletter, sign up to our socials, because the more, because we're trying so hard to get, government funding and things like that, and we can show our reach and our impact, the more people that come to our site, and then we can actually have better, like I imagine we'd have a really good website like Beyond Blue, where there's in the helplines and, you know, click here if you're a shift worker, click here if you're a new parent, like all, we'd have really good programs, and that's the vision for the future.
Amazing.
So that's why I'm so delighted to speak to you, George, and anyone who wants to speak to me about sleep, I just say yes, if I can fit it in.
Well, it's just such an important message, and I wish that more people, I wish I myself had prioritized sleep when I was younger, and now that I do, God, I feel the benefits. So I'm just also really passionate about it as well. But thank you so much for coming on today, sharing your wisdom, sharing your knowledge, and I'll be sure to sign up for all of your blogs and newsletters and things, and keep on improving my sleep. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thanks so much for doing that, and I can't wait to share the next episode with you.